Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avrigan. This day, March 30th, 1951, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg are convicted by a jury of conspiracy to commit espionage. The event actually took place on March 29th. We're doing this show. It's March 30th. We're talking about this. But the conviction of the Rosenbergs was the culmination of a series of confessions, exposés about Soviet spy networks, particularly related to U.S. nuclear weapons development. 7 days after they were convicted, Judge Irving Kaufman sentenced the couple to die, declaring them guilty of a, quote, crime worse than murder. On June 19th of 1953, the Rosenbergs were executed at Sing Sing Prison, the only American civilians executed for espionage during the Cold War. So here to discuss the case of the Rosenbergs, how much nuclear espionage changed the course of the Cold War, and lots of interesting twists and turns in this story are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello, Nikki. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And we have a special guest with us, Jamel Bowie of the New York Times, and it is made even more special by the fact that this is the one-year anniversary of this show. We started this show on March 31st, 2020, I believe, and Jamel was our first ever guest on this show, so he is back, and Jamel, you're now on the hook evermore on our anniversary. You will be our special guest.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me again. And congratulations on 1 year of the podcast.
I appreciate that. It has been, everyone has said it's been a heck of a year, but it has been a heck of a year. So, Nikki, let's start with the Rosenbergs themselves, and then we'll get to this larger context of what's going on in the early 50s. But what do we need to know about Julius and Ethel?
So they were spies, which is an important thing to know up front. Julius Rosenberg worked in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers during World War II, and during that period, he helped to recruit a number of people into a Soviet spy ring and was passing along nuclear secrets from the nuclear development that was going on in Los Alamos. And his wife, Ethel, was a communist and a pretty devout one, and she supported what he did. We'll get into the particulars of this case, how she supported him and to what extent she was involved in the particular crimes for which they were prosecuted is a pretty open question. But he is ultimately fired from the army in 1945 because he is outed as a member of the Communist Party.
What is your sense of the kinds of information that they are passing along? I mean, when you hear, you know, they are passing along nuclear secrets, that sounds very high stakes, but do we have any sense of kind of what actually is going on here?
I mean, he himself is recruiting people who are in Los Alamos, including his brother-in-law, these networks of engineers. So they are passing along information about how nuclear weapons get developed. And we should add that the Soviet Union tests its first nuclear weapons in 1949, and the U.S. had thought that they wouldn't be able to get this technology for 20 years. What we don't know is how much the information that was passed through this spy ring actually influenced the ability of the Soviet Union to develop nuclear weapons faster.
And that's another thing I want to get to in a bit, because I think it's a fascinating part of this story. But Jamel, do you have any thoughts on the Rosenbergs themselves, or kind of what do you think of when you look back at this story?
I mean, the thing that immediately comes to mind for me is that this is all taking place in a period of profound anti-communist paranoia. The McCarthy, you know, McCarthyism hasn't begun yet. That's not for another couple years. But key figures in McCarthyism will show up in the trial of the Rosenbergs. Roy Kahn was the prosecutor. You have, sort of in the backdrop of all of this, right-wing agitation about communists in the government, about sort of the New Deal left, which is still very much in the driver's seat of policymaking in the federal government, and fears of their influence and their perhaps sympathy to socialism, to communism. And so I, you know, for as much as the Rosenbergs were actually spies, it's also true that there's a certain amount of just outright hysteria happening in the United States right now that drives the events of this trial, the events of this controversy.
Yeah, I think this really sort of sets a precedent for the kind of overreaching and sort of like outlandish and aggressive tactics that are put into play by the federal government to sort of seek out anyone that they think is of nefarious behavior, even if that behavior is somewhat benign. You know, we see how the gamut all throughout the 1950s of how, you know, celebrities and everyday people are targeted and attacked for their political leanings toward communism. And so this really spirals out of control. But this is the case that I would say starts it all.
And so there's this interesting thing that we have to hold in our heads, which is, on the one hand, there was some level of guilt. You know, they were spies. But on the other hand, I think it's fair to say they were sort of railroaded or used it to create, you know, a sort of level of hysteria. And both those things are true at the same time. The fascinating thing, Kelly, and everyone can jump in on this, is, you know, if we are sort of exploring this dimension of them as scapegoats, them as part of history, like, why them, right? Mm. The Rosenbergs are a couple. There's a mother of two.
Yeah.
You know, why are they the ones who are now the sort of high-profile scapegoats?
Yeah. I say there's a number of reasons for that. You know, once it's clear that they're going to get caught, everyone starts snitching, right? Everyone starts scapegoating or blaming other people. And I do think that it's unfair how particularly Ethel was targeted in this investigation and really held accountable as though she was sort of a mastermind to this. And we can talk about, you know, why that is as well. But everyone starts to get roped in when the chips start to fall down and people are starting to realize just what could have happened. Not necessarily what did happen, but what could have happened.
Yeah, and I think that idea that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were kind of the linchpin of the spy ring makes them a particularly enticing target. And that they had, as Kelly was saying, all of these people snitching against them, including, you know, we mentioned that Julius Rosenberg had brought in his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law turns out to be the prosecution's chief witness. So he's not only testifying against his brother-in-law, but he brings his sister into it too. And this is one of the kind of tragic parts of the case, and I think speaks to Jamel's point about this being hysteria in addition to espionage. And that is, when he first came forward, David Greenglass was her brother. When he first comes forward, he says that she has nothing to do with it. And then, under pressure from the FBI, changes his story and says that she was typing up notes and passing them along. And later he comes forward and says, I said that in order to save my wife and myself.
The thing I wanted to jump in on is just more about the context in which this is happening. The Soviet Union had recently tested its first atomic bomb in the late 1940s. You have, in addition, sort of the Soviet Union trying to consolidate the territory it's gained over the past several years. And then you do have domestic pressure from within the national security state, from, you know, right-wing politicians. And so it's this thing, right, where if the Rosenbergs had been caught 5 years earlier, not clear that they would have been executed, right? But it's this particular confluence of global and domestic events that kind of create the pressure cooker that pushes towards their execution, right? Truman, who is inheriting FDR's legacy, wants to show that he's tough on communism. When the Rosenbergs are executed, when Eisenhower is president, Eisenhower has just negotiated a very unsatisfying truce in the Korean War. And so there's pressure on Eisenhower to demonstrate his strength against communism in the wake of this unsatisfying resolution. And so you can imagine, you know, had those events gone differently, had the Soviet Union taken longer to test its nuclear weapon, to get to developing a viable atomic weapon, Rosenbergs may not have been executed.
Or frankly, if, you know, another spy ring had sort of fallen into the lap of the FBI, right? I mean, just seems like it was like, this was the hand that the FBI was dealt at this particular moment. Hey, here are some spies to go after. And then, because of the political pressures you're describing, it becomes this much larger thing. Now, we mentioned Truman, we mentioned Eisenhower. there's another key figure here, Kelly, I think, mm-hmm. which is Hoover and the FBI yeah. director at the time. I mean, yeah. he has a really interesting role in taking all of this.
Yeah, Hoover's sympathetic, especially to Ethel. You know, he looks at her as a woman and as a mother and does not believe that she deserves death or that this couple deserves death. And Eisenhower takes a completely different approach. You know, he really invokes sort of like the classic Eve ideology, which is like the woman made me do it, and blames mm-hmm. all of this on her, says that she deserves no mercy, considers her to be the mastermind, considers Julius to be sort of like this weak-minded man that was manipulated by her. So I think there's a lot of gender politics that go into this as well, into who we deem as, you know, the leader of this, but also who's worthy of death. I mean, these are high crimes that we're talking about. And the fact that, you know, a couple is executed that has young children, it's no small thing, that's for sure.
And the thing is, Hoover isn't wrong. There is this massive national and international outcry that happens. There are thousands of letters and telegrams pouring into the White House. 7,000 people show up at the White House for a vigil, including their two sons, who are little boys at the time. Their oldest child writes a little note that says, please let my mommy and daddy go and not let anything happen to them. But you also have big international players as well, like the Pope intervenes, Albert Einstein, people
Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah.
Let's not forget Jean-Paul Sartre. They all kind of weigh in and say, please don't kill this couple. And in particular, please don't kill this mother and make mm-hmm. these children orphans. And Eisenhower is unmoved.
I think the children are really important here, both because of the way that it changes the national conversation, but also because in subsequent years, these children, the two sons, grow up and they continue to champion this case. And so they have written books and they've talked about this. And, you know, over the course of certainly into the 80s and 90s, I think just this, the story of what happened to the Rosenbergs continues to get fleshed out. And it becomes even, I think, more apparent, this sort of railroading as we're describing. You know, so in the there's some reporting in the 80s and 90s that shows that, you know, the FBI itself was never really convinced of Ethel Rosenberg's guilt and was just kind of like, well, this is, you know, the kind of hand we're dealt, we have to kind of push here. And then the other element that I think really emerges is this sense of Judge Kaufman. And when we talk about criminal justice, so often it's about a judge, you know, and their disposition. And Judge Kaufman just really had it in for them. And, you know, we hear that in the way he describes their crimes as, quote, worse than murder.
I would just like to say that this is not the issue at hand, but it just goes to show you how problematic the death penalty is and how, mm-hmm. like, that still has to be reckoned with in terms of who we deem worthy of death and what's a crime punishable by death, and how that plays out, you know, is something that's needs another discussion for sure.
That's what I was thinking this whole time, Kelly, which is that, I mean, they're executed within just a few years of this sentence being handed down. And of course, there have been so many different changes in jurisprudence and in law around death penalty that doesn't happen in the same way anymore. But it is still a system encoded with a great deal of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start to wrap up. But Jamel, you know, if you take a step back or you look back at this story from now, I mean, what is your sense of the Rosenberg story? Has the way that we view them changed over time?
You know, I'm not sure what the big picture view of this case is in the present. I mean, I think a nuanced look will probably touch on both sides of this, right? That, as we've discussed, you have this larger context of the mounting Red Scare, of anti-communism, of sort of the after almost two decades of dormancy, a resurgent American right. You also have on the other side, you know, a liberal left that was very defensive of the Rosenbergs and was arguably somewhat discredited by the fact that they did turn out to be spies. And that this, you know, for as much as the cause of opposing the execution may have been just, this, in the eyes of many Americans, helped taint the left that was already under pressure at the time. I think for the U.S. government, I mean, to evaluate the U.S. government, I think that a big picture look at the government's behavior shows it to have behaved, I think, pretty it's deplorably too strong of a word, pretty poorly here, precisely because of the degree to which the couple was railroaded, the degree to which this did have global repercussions for American foreign policy, right? You had allies in countries like France that were opposed to the execution. You had protests against the execution in Italy, throughout Europe. And there was a sense that this was the United States kind of going entirely too far in its anti-communism. So this may end this. I think you can make a case that this ended up being kind of counterproductive for the United mm-hmm. States, and certainly I think tainted the idea that the U.S. was sort of the defender of, you know, justice and human rights mm-hmm. that the country was actively trying to cultivate in the wake of the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think it points to the nuances around the case in a way that makes it less politically useful these days, yeah. which is why we don't hear as much about the Rosenbergs right. as we mm-hmm. hear about someone like Alger Hiss, who had been engaged in spying, but was in the upper echelons of the Roosevelt administration. And so is much more useful politically for people today than a case like the Rosenbergs.
I'll say this as a small tidbit. I love the show The Americans. And I think a large part of that's based off the Rosenbergs, you know, this ordinary couple with two kids and a dog, you know, like
totally.
Great series if anyone wants to know.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring up pop culture, because as I was reading about this, I also noticed that there's a Sidney Lumet film called Daniel from 1983. Sidney yeah. Lumet's maybe my favorite director. This film I've never seen, actually, but 1983, and Daniel's the name of one of the sons, but it's the story of the Rosenbergs. It has a 43% on Rotten Tomatoes. But Jamel, you are a big, big movie buff, and I'm curious, have you seen this film, Daniel?
No, I haven't seen. I'm also, Sidney Lumet is also one of my favorite directors. I think tremendously underrated. I could go on for this for a long time. I have not
seen spinoff at some point, but yeah.
I've not seen Daniel. I was shaking. I was nodding because I had recently read Sidney Lumet's book on making movies called Making Movies, and he talks about that film quite a bit as both a difficult shoot, as something that was not particularly critically well received, but as something sort of illustrating movies with tough emotional subjects. So I've not seen the film. I kind of want to see it now.
Yeah, I do too.
Just right. because it's sometimes a director's most interesting movies are their failures.
All right. So if listeners have seen Daniel, get in touch and tell us if that 43% is on Rotten Tomatoes is merited or not. But either way, we'll watch it in the next couple of weeks and report back. But Jamel Bowie, The New York Times, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And yeah, this is our first show of our second year. So listeners, I just want to say thank you for being with us. And we're really having fun, and there's a lot more to be done over the course of this year. We are back looking at the calendar and have all sorts of fun stories. If you have any suggestions for topics, you can always get in touch with us, thisdaypod@gmail.com. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.